This is Dave Monk and Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial, and Dave on the board.
Of course, always.
So we have guests today, the Chenoweth family, and we'll introduce those in a minute. I wanted to say that Strawberry Fields is still in action, if you don't know. The Elhedy family has taken that over and remodeled it, but a lot of the chairs or items that are there were Strawberry Fields as they were in the past. So you should visit that sometime. Tom Pantham had a 60th birthday, and that was a party in the old railroad station, and a lot of people were meeting each other for the first time sometimes, or were old friends. And it's Leatrice time, so you should find a little prairie and find that Leatrice is blooming. It's a bluish-purple spike. There's two breeds that we have. One is a full plume, and the other one is a button, a little buttons up stem. So then I think we'll introduce David and Gloria and Daniel, whom we all know from being on WEF before. So let's have David introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his science background, and now he's retired. He's into well health, and okay.
Yeah. Again, my name is Dave Chenoweth. The last time I was on this program was in 2007, and I talked about global warming. And we had recently gotten back from Australia, and Gloria and I actually played the didgeridoo. I don't think we'll have time to play the didgeridoo today, but at least I would like to tell you a little bit about myself. For the past 30 years, I've been a professor in the area of environmental microbiology, and the focus of interest of my research was making methane. And so we were making methane out of waste, and even a huge project that would produce all the world's methane from seaweed using a tenth of the area of the ocean. And most of our food also. So anyway, that's something I've been interested in for years. I retired in 2005, and I've moved into completely different areas, which kind of surprised me, but it just happened. I was studying spirituality all through my career, and I really see spirituality as being something above and beyond religion. And when you get to the spiritual level, most of the religions are very similar, and you can go to the mystics and you'll find that they all are saying pretty much the same thing. So I studied spirituality in some great extent. In fact, I'm an ordained minister and also a Catholic. So if they really knew that, they'd probably kick me out of the Catholic Church. But I'm in charge, co-leading a spiritual center in Gainesville called the Seraphim Center. And you can Google that at seraphimcenter.org and find out what that's all about. I also studied hypnotherapy, and I started doing counseling for people using hypnosis. And then after doing that, or in addition to doing that, I learned two methods of healing people. And I'm now doing healing. And I heal them by releasing trapped emotions. That's one thing I do. And changing belief systems. So that gives you some idea where I am today. And I'm going to try to weave all that into what I talk about. And I think I'll introduce my wife, Gloria, and she can tell you a little bit about herself.
So I'm Gloria Chenoweth, and been Dave's cohort in crime, if you want to say, for almost 49 years, though we've known each other for about 55 years. So I won't give our age, but I will say that it's been a while. So we have had the fortune of having three kids, of which One is Danielle, who's going to be talking in just a few minutes. And we just have experienced so much. As you can see, Dave has just evolved in many different ways. And I think that has also led me and probably the family to do that evolution where I feel that there's a movement away from the thought of more the nuclear to a much more expanded view of life, of community. And this has been very, very, it's been an evolution, but it's been a very interesting, and I feel as we explore this area, it just gets to be more and more broad and more enticing as we move into it. And I'll turn it over now to Danielle, our daughter, and you may know her already.
Danielle Chenoweth, as of this year, a 20-year resident of Urbana, Illinois. I moved here in 1995 from Florida, where my parents are still based, to work with a performing group now known as the School for Designing a Society. In fact, I still work with that group. Susan Parenti and Mark Enslin are the directors of that school. And when my parents say they're partners in crime, that is so true. I think one of the things, you know, we talked about sharing with the listening audience this morning is just what it's like to grow a family that really takes into consideration the well-being of the community and the society as a whole. So I think as I've gotten older, I'm 43, just turned 43 in June. Exactly, like I'm now officially an old person. And now I have a son who's 4 years old, and he's sitting outside playing with my friend Chris Evans. And I have, as I think happens when you have children, this newfound sense of like, where did my values come from, and what values do I want my child to have? And I think I knew that before he was born, but like, how do I then transfer those values? So I think my parents, some of, you know, what I'm interested in exploring today is how did we grow up really embracing the concept of social change and community well-being in everything that we do? And I realize as an adult that that isn't necessarily a given, that not all families do that. And I think it would be interesting for folks to hear kind of our approach and how we've done that, because I'm the product of the two people sitting next to me, largely. And we had a...
Ezra, your son, will
exactly
have the same situation.
And, you know, and I think fondly about the how they brought me into the concept that other people are our responsibility, and that we should always be looking at where are we in the clock of the world right now, and what is our contribution to making the world a better place.
Okay. Well, I would like to introduce our topic, at least my part of the topic for today, and I call it Core Wisdom. And I have a blog, if you wish to look that up. It's corewisdom.blogspot.com. Also, I'm on Twitter, and my username is Dave Chen. D-A-V-E-C-H-Y-N. So what is core wisdom all about? I think what led me to this is every time I get into an argument, sometimes with our daughter or with my wife, we're always talking about what's wrong with society or what's wrong with this. And these are symptoms. And when you go to a doctor, you go to the doctor and they sometimes, not always, guess or determine what your symptoms are, and then they give you a pill, you know? So there aren't any pills for the world. There's no pill you can take to get the right government to do that type of thing. And unfortunately, most people are treating symptoms, even most healers, people that do acupuncture. We go to an acupuncturist, we get treated, and in a month, we go back with the same problem. We treat ourselves for acid reflux, and we take these pills, and it comes right back. Well, unfortunately, our government is doing the same thing as the medical profession. They're treating symptoms, problems, without really getting down to what are the issues, how do we want it to be? We don't want this law or that law, but what do we want life to look for us? And basically, my feeling is we want to be happy, free from fear, and at peace. So that's a core value that we're striving at. And instead of arguing about capitalism versus socialism and all these kinds of things, that's basically what we're trying to do. My answer to how to do that is that we should be one, oneness. I call it oneness. And the process of doing that is called oneing. Okay? So oneness means that I'm part of you, I'm part of you, I'm part of each and every person in this world, but I'm also a part of every animal, I'm a part of every plant, and I'm one with all creation.
Holistic,
right. And it's about oneness versus independence. The opposite of oneness is I'm independent, and I'm going to get ahead at the expense of everybody and everything else. And that's my goal in life, is to get ahead.
That's very American.
You've
come to a country where there's resources and everyone has anticipated that they can do their own thing.
Yeah. And what most people don't realize, that if everyone around you is doing well, you'll do much better. You won't have to have a gate on your community. You won't have to have glass bottles around the wall. You won't have to worry about being kidnapped, because you won't have really severely poor people around you. So a lot of people don't really understand that, or else they would really differ in terms of their core basis for their belief system. In this country, often it's broken down politically in terms of capitalism versus socialism. And we all saw a play written by Susan Parente, who lives in this town, which was really good, and it's called Unrequited, and it was just lovely. It really did a good idea of discussing the differences between these. Of course, they aren't the only two political systems, but they tend to prevail. In 2009, I wrote several editorials on the state of the United States and my view on it. I wrote a general article, which I'm going to read, and then it's followed by detailed articles on economy, the health system, and I'm writing the one on energy. So you can go to my blog spot and read those and get caught up. So right now I'm going to read the overall state of the U.S., and then I'll turn it over to others to open it up for discussion. For several years, I have believed that the U.S. has been losing ground as a leading nation, and that our leadership and political policies have guided our country into a lifestyle and way of conducting business that is not sustainable or ethical in many areas, including economic and labor policies, environmental management and resource use, medical care, care for the homeless and financially deprived, education, civil rights, penal philosophy and practice, international relations and policies, and defense.
That's pretty much everything,
right? And my other articles discuss this in detail. In general, our people and government have addressed the symptoms rather than the core causes of problems in each of these areas. To a great extent, policies have been driven by personal and vested interest and not by science and the welfare of the people. We all know about global warming, even though it's unanimously believed by scientists, many people don't. In fact, our governor says it's against the law to even mention global warming in Florida. In future communications, I will elaborate and clarify those views. So now, this is my view on economy. Our economy should aim for steady state and stable conditions instead of continued expansion. We should localize our economy by minimizing imports and keeping services and production of goods within our country. All workers should make a living wage and should be registered U.S. residents with some provision for authorized temporary residents from other countries. Transfer of funds should be primarily related to goods or services received. Loans and activities related to speculation of the future should be heavily regulated and significantly taxed. Sustainable environmental practices must be strived for by maximizing recycle, minimizing disposal of waste into the environment, prevention of resource depletion, and minimizing destruction of natural environments. We must evaluate and regulate major polluting industries, such as landfilling, agriculture, fossil fuel extraction, like fracking, and use, mining, water use, and forestry, especially lumber and paper industries. Basically, affordable medical care and drugs should be available to all legal residents and visitors. Layered medical care practices should range from simple nursing care to special medical services provided by doctors and medical specialists. Incentives should be provided to encourage U.S. residents to improve their health, for example, healthy diets and exercise. Unhealthy products such as alcohol, foods with added sugar, tobacco products, and alcoholic beverages should be heavily taxed. Every resident should be entitled to have their basic needs met, that is, food, shelter, and medical care. Group homes should be established to help those with mental and physical and addiction health problems. Prisons should be viewed as rehabilitation institutions, which strive to be self-sufficient and provide counseling and training. Halfway houses and job opportunities should be provided for these released prisoners. Capital punishment should be abolished. Education through undergraduate college level should be free for all residents. Students should be grouped on the basis of aptitude so education can be optimized and focused. Education at all levels should include basic knowledge, creativity, and life management skills. Laws should be instituted to minimize discrimination of individuals based on age, gender, sexual preference, or religion. Legislation of morality should be minimized. Issues should be clarified by open dialogue regarding controversial issues such as abortion, stem cell research, capital punishment, euthanasia, and gay rights. Strong policies should be instituted to address and improve international relations. The U.S. should encourage formation of an international government agency, IGA, with funds and personnel provided from all participating nations. The IGA should play a governing role in international defense, security, disaster, economic and environmental issues. Member nations should collectively decide and act on matters related to terrorism, internal oppression, response to natural disasters, and regulation of global issues such as greenhouse gases, fishing practices, and water use. Movement should be toward diplomacy and away from war and use of weapons of mass destruction. All able-bodied men and women should be required to provide civil service and be trained as reservists on call for civil and other defense issues. And that's the end.
Daniel, can you make any comment on that? Because you're a part of this, mm-hmm. and you have a media interest, you have social justice interest, and so elaborate on this just a little bit.
Well, a couple of things. First, thanks, Dad. That was I read parts of that in the Gainesville Sun. I appreciate hearing it again. So one question I have is, where do people get to think about and put forward a platform like you just did? And what is the process by which we create platforms and then discuss them and work towards developing kind of a people's platform?
I read the same article and had the same thought.
And so
where do you find this in a major university?
Yeah, so one of the things, first off, I think that part of being a person, there are things I agree with and things I disagree with, and we could talk about the details of that in it. But generally speaking, people are not called. You would think in a democracy we would be called to think deeply about the issues of that face us socially and develop, whether it be manifesto, platforms, et cetera. And one of the things that I think the World Social Forum does, and it's about to happen this next month in Ghana, actually is a place where every couple of years, people from social groups and social movements across the country come together, and they really work in small committee to like develop what is the people's agenda moving forward. And in this country, we have a structure called the U.S. Social Forum. It happened this year. They tried a distributed model, which I don't think was very successful. But typically, it's been every 2 years in a major city. The last before then was in Detroit in 2010. They skipped a few years, and then they had one in Philadelphia and one in, I believe, Mexico, and maybe Jackson. So these are places where people come together and they really figure out, like, what is the vision that we should be putting forward? And I guess one resource I would direct people to who are listening is that the Grace Lee Boggs is a, she's been on the planet for 90 years. I actually think there's really a lot to be learned from people who have been on the planet and have seen many, many different movements. My folks, you know, in their 70th decade, I won't give a specific date, Grace Lee Boggs in her 90th decade, you in your 80th decade,
decades are 10 years.
What?
So you mean 7th decade, not 70th. The 70th decade would be 700.
Thank
that's
you.
Methuselah turf.
Now I made you really prehistoric, right? Thank you, Dave. But to great what Grace Lee Boggs has seen and what you have seen, and I've watched you now for, I'm 43 years, an evolution of your way of thinking about things where you think deeply about what the issues are. And then the question is like, okay, you've got this platform. Where do we take it so that it can engage with other people and their platforms? And I think the U.S. Social Forum and the World Social Forum is partly a place for that. I think there was an idea that the UN could be a place for that, where nations could. There are also these big convergences on race that happen. Obama didn't, you know, in his first year of office, didn't attend, which was surprising and a sign that things were going to go awry. And these big convenings about gender, you know, because we're really dealing with race. I mean, we're dealing with systemic violence based on race, gender, and violence against the environment, and it's going to have huge consequences for us. So I guess I'm thinking meta level when I look at this. I'm thinking like, okay, now you've got a platform. You've really thought about it. It has decades of thought into it. Where do we go where it engages its gears with others?
How does the internet interject in this debate? Has it liberated people to be able to exchange with each other? What are the advantages and disadvantages of the internet to this sort of thing? To get more or less an international university or a national university that discusses these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're very ethereal, because people who are thinking and dreaming are often lonely people, and they're thinking differently, so that even their friends and relatives are thinking critically and arguing the point. And so where, it's like you say, where do you find the font of energy for this sort of thing? Is it on the internet?
Well, so we would not know the name Ferguson were it not for the internet and the movement for Black Lives that is, I think, the quintessential movement right now in this country, the one that we should be paying attention to and supporting, really came out of a million tweets by folks who either had experienced violence, police-based violence, or had witnessed it. And it was only after the million tweets did we actually see the mainstream press pick it up. And so one way I can answer your question is to say that what we're seeing, and that being one example of many that I could point to, is that the internet, a free and open internet, free of discrimination, one that is regulated by net neutrality, actually does provide that. Ultimately, we want it to be fully accessible, affordable for all, and publicly controlled and owned. That's what the internet should be. It's not. But we have some variation on that. The other way I could answer the question is that the internet allows all kinds of things to happen, and we'll be able to have and can have conversations where we can see each other in space, but we don't have to spend all this money and gas traveling across the country to have conversations with each other. That said, once the conversation kind of bubbled up with the movement for Black Lives, the conversations to go deeper have happened person to person. So this coming weekend in Cleveland, Ohio, the movement for Black Lives, including at least three that we're sending from the Independent Media Center here, there are people coming from all over, Black folks coming from all over the country to really talk about what do we need to do to deepen this movement and move it forward so that we do not have another Sandra Bland. We did not have another Trayvon Martin. We did not have another Kewan Carrington. And so when we look at this movement, I think it embodies a couple of the elements of success for moving an agenda forward. One is that connection across the globe on the internet where people can come to voice and see each other and feel confidence that there are others out there facing this. The second is deepening connections in your local community. So I actually think going local is an essential part of the social change, is that face-to-face, human, neighbor-to-neighbor kind of connection, things like WEFT provides by being a small kind of community space to have conversations, you know. And then, being able to kind of bring those two conversations together with a lot of heart. And so I think the last thing I'd say about the movement for Black Lives, just as an example, is that it's led by queer Black women who really understand the issue of intersectional violence based on race, gender, and sexual orientation. And those women bring a very soulful, love-based value system to that movement. So that's one way, just using a current example, that I would answer your question.
I've watched generations of people from different countries go. In three generations, I've seen Irish people go to doctoral programs. At the same time, in the same time frame, I don't see the same number of Black community people reaching. In fact, some of them have dropped back. So
exactly. And so I think one of the things is my dad was talking about symptoms instead of core premises. And I think if you take that example and you dig a little bit deeper into it, you realize, the story that we have of emancipation, the story that we have that civil rights has now rectified us and gotten us to a race blind place, is a false story, right? And that the symptom of Black folks in our community not being able to access this university in their own backyard is really part of the fact that there has been an ongoing structural violence against African Americans that went from slavery to Jim Crow to New Jim Crow. So Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, I recommend it to everyone who's listening to get an analysis of kind of why is it that the Irish folks you've seen can go on and get their PhD and what has been the issue with African Americans. And I think it's the Movement for Black Lives that has been able to show people that, you know, you've got a systematic, regular, daily violence suppression happening of black folks, both state-based and vigilante, as well as a structural violence that keeps people from really being able to succeed. Because we know that human beings, right, we know our creative capacity. We know that when we are given the opportunity, we are able to make community, build connections, establish loving relationships, and grow. And so if you see that that's not happening, then you have to start looking deeper from those symptoms to the deeper causes and the deeper causes.
One of the things is tolerance. Do you see the internet encouraging tolerance of different issues, different personalities, different policies?
Well, I'd be curious what you all think, but I'll just answer and I can pass it on, which is I think that the internet tends to get groups of people who are like-minded together to reinforce certain understandings. And so that's good because folks who are very isolated, like trans people in rural America, very isolated category of people, and they're the ones who have the highest amount of violence, police-based violence against them, you know, they can now connect with people who are also trans folks across the country. And so we see people coming together and coming to voice in those groups. We also see a lot of hate and a lot of, you know, people sharing information on the internet and kind of, you know, and so we track that as well and look at like people kind of festering certain ideas about other people online. So I really think what we know from the research and also from my background in organizing is that the internet is not, it's a tool that helps with organizing, but what really changes folks is that we sit down, we look at each other and we talk. I came out to my parents as queer after I came out to my parents to the city of Urbana as queer, okay? So that says something, right? I knew when I was 16. And yet when I finally sat down with my parents in 2001 and I was scared to death and I sent them a letter and I called our family priest and we got together. And once I realized, you know, I need to actually talk this through with them because we're not going to have a relationship going forward. And I want to draw them closer instead of pushing them away. And so it was through many conversations that continue to this day that we're able to actually hear each other out and change our minds. And that really happens around the dinner table. That really happens, you know, person by person. And I think that's difficult to achieve on the internet.
I'm reading a book by Jane Fonda, who has in her lifetime done a lot of these things. Back to Dave.
Yeah, I had one more comment regarding how to get people to look at things this way. The big problem, like we went to this play last night and it was all liberal people. So we're speaking to the choir.
Yes.
And we speak to the choir too often. People either watch Fox News or they watch NPR. You know, and both of them are really biased. They, when they have their forums, they emphasize their particular views, and there's no basis for discussion. And again, when there is discussion, like one of my favorite is the Diane Rehm show, they're discussing the symptoms. They're not discussing the underlying reference point and cause. That's what's really lacking. We went, Gloria and I went to a death penalty workshop at our church years ago. And at that time, I believed in the death penalty. I wasn't a strong advocate, but
This is news to me for the group. What year was this?
Yeah, it was like 30 years ago or something. And we went there, and they presented both sides. You know, even though it was a fairly liberal Catholic church, they presented both sides, and they somehow got people. So all of a sudden, there was this dialogue, and we had people there with the facts. So the facts came out, you know, And this is what's really lacking in the only time I don't even see this in the presidential debates. They don't discuss their, their overall objective. When you have an organization?
Values or principles?
No, I'm trying to think of it. Mission statement. Oh. They don't discuss their mission statement. You know, they just say, we want this, we want that, and they don't really put it into any kind of context.
To some extent, I think you're trying to get people together by looking at their sociology, their backgrounds, and it's in an area where you have a language that we may not have. Yeah. I'm thinking of working with dolphins and trying to find out what their language is. We're working with you who've been working with mind bending and we don't know your language. And that goes back to where we need a university or a place where we can discuss these things. Say something about your health and how you look at a mind and a personality, and how do you work with people to give them a background so they understand what was past and what might, it was almost Freudian. Yeah. So say something along those lines. Yeah. I think we're looking at well health as a part of the whole.
Well, I'm going to make a very controversial statement. I believe most...
That's not a first, by the way.
I believe that most, if not all, mental and physical problems come from belief systems. And basically, the core cause of mental and health problems are false beliefs. And so the flow of things in your mind... Or you're exposed to a stimulus, like a hot stove, you touch it, you know? What is the next thing that happens? When you hear something or see something, you come up with a belief system. I touch that stove, it's hot, it's going to burn me. So you pull it away, you know? But a lot of our belief systems, like, for example, if you hate spinach, like my mother stuffed spinach down my mouth when I was 2 years old, you know, and my mouth was filled with it. And I hated spinach all my life because so I had this trapped belief system. It was trapped. Now, belief systems, so we have the stimulus, we have the belief systems. The belief systems cause emotion. You see a tiger chasing you. What is the emotion that comes after that? It's fear. Okay? Fear. And then once you have the emotion, then the emotion makes you sick. It makes you either mentally or physically sick. You might throw up from fear, or if you have to give a talk on this show, you know, like I gagged on my vitamin this morning because I was a little bit anxious, you know, so basically it results in a symptom. So symptoms are caused by emotions. Emotions are caused by belief systems. Belief systems are caused by stimuli. And I have a method of releasing these trapped emotions, and it's called the emotion code. And that's how I heal people. That book, the base for that is called Emotion Code, and the author is Bradley Nelson. Okay, and then the other thing I do to heal people is change their belief systems. Like one core belief system. So using that word core again. One of the core belief systems that I have a whole list of about 30 of them. In fact, I did this on Dave Monk. That's why he's looking so happy. Because we released all of his emotions and changed all of his belief systems, the false ones. So one of the belief systems is I want to live. If you test negative for I want to live, then that's a big problem. Another really important one that comes up a lot is I accept myself and others for the wrongs done to me, and I forgive myself and others for this. Okay, so how do I test for these belief systems? I use a pendulum. And the pendulum tells me I can answer any yes or no question. I use this all the time. So this is yes, and that's no. Okay? So that's what I do. Like, I have a right to live, and it's saying yes. Danny has a right to live. It's saying no for her. So we need to do some work on her, but she won't let me do it. So I actually do this remotely. I don't even have to see the person. I don't even have to know their problems. And it takes me 15 minutes. And their emotions are released, and their negative belief systems change from negative to positive.
And sounds almost metaphysical.
It is definitely metaphysical. I'm almost embarrassed to say I'm a scientist and talking about this. But all I know is I've healed about 90% of the people that I've worked with. I mean, I even healed the leaders of several nations that are involved in conflict, and things have seemed to be improving as a result of doing
that. Well, yeah, do a little bit more of that, I think.
Yes, keep that up.
Very mystical, I can remember. World War II, the Australians had a gentleman that could stand on the harbor, and he could tell people where ships were in the ocean, and nobody could figure out how he could do this.
Yeah.
And he could do it over and over. So you're in a territory. Can you go to the Catholic Church, for instance, and can you get a doctorate in theology thinking about this sort of thing? Is it heretical within the church? How do you encourage other people to think about this, and how do you get people together to do it?
Well, we have, you know, you tend to attract like minds, and we have a group of about 8 people to get together once a week, and we discuss our healings. And this method of putting these together is one that I developed. Even though I'm using other people's methods, I put the two together. And then I also see people one-on-one afterwards to discuss the results. It would take a whole show to go into the details of this, but what makes it believable is I tell people how old they were when this emotion became trapped, and whether it was related to their mother or their father or a visitor or a sibling, and it tells that. And so then they can relate to it. They said, my God, how did he know that my father did this or that they divorced that year or whatever? Because I know this without even knowing the people.
Well, some of this relates to actually people having the opportunity to talk to you in the first place. People who have not had that sort of opportunity to talk to each other suddenly discover that they can have friends and talk. But it's almost like water divining. You take two sticks and you find... By talking, you're finding things that would be like water.
Yeah, I actually can find water. I've found water. One thing I failed to mention, that when I do this healing, I go into a trance, and I talked about oneness. I become one with that person, and then I heal myself. That's kind of how I do it. I actually join their spirit and become one with it.
So how do you work with the neuroscientists that are finding that are hormones and enzymes and minute...
Neurotransmitters.
They're all symptoms.
They're all symptoms?
Yeah. They're not the original cause of the problem. They're symptoms. They're a response of the mind. The mind can change DNA, actually. It can cause changes in DNA.
Okay, so scientifically, the neurotransmitters help you understand the divisions of the brain and how you might work with it.
Well, you don't have to understand this for it to work. It works independent of your left brain. This is not left brain at all. Learning and education is all left brain. This is right brain. It's all subconscious at a subconscious level. Which is hard to understand, but it's...
Well, if I may tell a story.
Yeah, yes.
about he was talking about divining, and it was very interesting. About a year ago, we were having a water problem in our front yard, and lo and behold, Dave pulls out his divining rod, and the people who came to fix it could not figure out where this particular line, which could run almost anywhere in our yard.
Could you have to take up your whole yard to find it?
Had to take up the whole yard to find it. So he said, when they said, well, they'll come tomorrow and they'll start digging. And he said, well, just give me a day and I'll show you where it is. Well, sure enough, he pulled out his divining rod and he walked down to the front of our yard and over to the side. He started getting a feeling from this divining rod. And he said, this is where it is. Now, our yard is big. You know, we have about an acre of yard. So you get an idea of what this pinpoint is like. Sure enough, we went and got a shovel, and within a couple of inches, there was the connection. There was the break in the connection, and it was in the where the water was pooling. And we couldn't tell that before because the water was seeping through and going out in other places. So we couldn't find it by going to where the water was coming up. We had to use that divining rod, and it was just amazing. So anyway, I think that's an example of the divining rod and how it has worked for us. But
one of just have my voice, and I have a question for my mom here. Is so when my father first started doing this, my dad has gone through a lot of different. He's interested in everything, and he goes through different fads, and he's to me, you're really an experimenter. Like you're as a scientist, you were an experimenter, and you made great breakthroughs in how to basically take organic waste and turn it into gas. Spiritually, you're an experimenter. You're experimenting with your thoughts, and it's something I really value about you. And so as he was, pulling out the crystals and things, I'm like, oh my goodness. And first off, he has healed a lot of friends of mine who have asked him, including some people I live with. And so there's real the contributions there. The second is that I started to think about it. Both of my parents are really healers. And I think part of the tradition of healing that has lived for many thousands of years is that people cultivate their awareness of themselves and others and their spiritual awareness. And so my entire life, I started to connect the pendulum and the healing of my friends with the fact that my parents wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and they read, they pray, they explore, they talk. They've always been in conversation both with folks who are incarcerated. They've visited prisons, for 30 years. Folks on death row or lifers, and then, and folks in the community. It's not just, the white suburban Catholics they've had conversations with. There's been a lot of different kinds of people they've had conversations with, and they've deepened their own spiritual connection. And then I think what happens when you do that is that you develop your powers. I mean, there's something to be said for the wise woman and the wise man and the powers they're able to heal and the many centuries of that. And so I see it in that context. What I want to ask my mom, so I have always seen my mom as a healer. She's healed a lot of people. She healed all of us when we were children, and she's visited people in need and in pain. And I'll tell one story, and I want to ask kind of how you did it. Is that when I was a kid, we were always being taken to somebody's house, usually someone who was very sick or in pain. And there was one woman, Jeannie, who had was in traction and had severe pain such that they had to actually cut nerves to stop some of the pain response. She didn't say, oh, this is too much for these little kids. She brought us with, and we would change the bedclothes. We would help turn people's bodies. We would talk afterwards and ask. And I think a lot of my sense of humanity comes from, and my sense of my own privilege comes from being able to be with my parents, both of them having done these visits for a long time. So I want to ask my mom, is this, did your family raise you in this way? And if not, how did you get from kind of where you were when you were born to deciding that, that you really wanted to bring homeless people into your home and shelter them, that you wanted to minister to the sick, to those who are dying in hospice? I mean, what was that? What kind of brought you into that way of thinking?
Good question, Dan. I'll give that some thought. No, I think part of it is, yes, I think it comes from upbringing. But I also think that it comes from a situation that we faced as a family of moving around, not having the anchor of the immediate family, the parents, grandparents, and so on and so forth. We had moved around because of Dave's work. And so it was really getting involved and just seeing around our neighborhood, for instance, Jeannie, for instance, that she mentioned. It was through church. We were talking about this poor woman who was having problems, and there were a number of us who came forward and said, this is really important for us to do something. And then bringing the kids along was just kind of part of it. I think we just kind of fell into this. I don't know that other people brought their kids, but it was Jeannie happened to have kids of her own. Our kids were there to play with or to enjoy the toys if the parents went around. And it just evolved. But I think that later, as I looked back, I think we were looking for the opportunities to begin to put feet on a lot of the things that Dave talked about. Some of the things where we talk about the situation in a broader scale of how we as individuals can be able to carry out some of these things, some of these feelings that we have, some of these awarenesses that we have. And I think, for instance, we moved into a neighborhood and we didn't have any grandparents. And it was really our oldest daughter who really started looking for grandparents. She knew that we needed some anchor. So she began to tell us, Mom, there's a person down there that she's having this problem. And no, this person across the way is having this problem. And so we began contacting these people, taking coffee and cookies, and the kids came along because they were part of the family. And so it was just kind of a natural thing to do. Now, whether we would have done that much if we had been in a nuclear, in a more expanded family with grandparents and so forth and so on, I don't know. But I do know that opportunity was there for us to take advantage of. And we just kind of fell right into it and went and took advantage of it. And the kids, I never even thought about them doing anything differently. And I don't think they did either. They just came along and did.
Yes. I have a question for you. It is touted that for a family, as a woman, you have to take at least 6 years to raise a child. That takes you out of circulation. And so do you feel that that's been a disadvantage for you to be adjacent to someone who hasn't had to have quite the same involvement with child raising? You have a husband that can't feed a child, for instance, or nurse a child. It seems to me that we're getting more even in a way. And women have come a long way with some of this sort of thing. In fact, we need to bring the men up to be able to take a leave to do child raising. Can you say something about that gap, which is there biologically, that you need to raise a family?
Well, if I understand, Dave, I think what I would say is that, again, this was a different era when I was bringing up my kids. But I watched this era, and it's really exciting to
yes.
see the gender, the two genders, when it comes to those things that we used to kind of divide. You know, this is what a woman did, this is what a man did. And we've taken that, and we've blurred it, we've crossed it. And I think that's really important, because what has happened is that men now have more of a feeling when it comes to child raising, possibly, yeah. And women have more of a feeling of what it's like to be, have a career that you're really bringing in money and bringing in the support for the family that maybe we didn't have as much in those days when I was bringing up our own kids. I worked intermittently. I didn't work on a consistent basis, which gave me that time. But now, with the man and the woman being able to divide, they then each can take time so that each can give their gifts, not just to the family, but to the community. Whereas yes. I don't think that happened before, or wasn't able to be as possible as it is now. And I think that's a wonderful step, a wonderful progress that we've made.
Daniel is in a different era. And she's experienced a different sort of liberality here. Can you say something about having real jobs, being on the city council, being working in independent media? How do you do these things? and have a child?
Well, so I had Ezra in 2011, and I had planned for him for about 4 years. I'm a single mom by choice. And so I had one of my best friends donate to my cause, and he's involved in Ezra's life, and his parents are involved, and I feel very lucky to have that. I am the sole breadwinner for my family. My family is not only my son, but also a family of choice that includes several folks who are on disability. What's interesting is, my job, I'm now the organizing director for the Center of Media Justice out of Oakland, California. So I travel once a month for my job, and I live here in Urbana. So it's tricky. And what I would say is, it's thrilling to be able to work for social justice all day, every day, and have that be my paid position. And I've really transitioned out of my work as an IT consultant, and haven't been on city council since 2008. But it is the case that somehow, while I was raising Ezra with support from a community of friends, and working full-time, I also ran Carol Ammon's campaign in the primary, which was the really tough election, in my opinion. And I was her campaign manager. And I think the way that I did that is to not agree with the segregation of the child from public life. And so when I speak before city council, I mean, I've nursed and spoke to city council on public television. I do that because otherwise I'm going to have to stay home or choose not to nurse my child or pump. And I don't enjoy doing that. And I've found a job where I can work from home and he goes to preschool, but I'm able to, able to pick him up and drop him off. And I have a community of care to support that. So different people do it in different ways, but I agree with what my mom said is that we're seeing a lot of, we're seeing the importance of gender distinction really minimized. And we're finding new and more creative ways of mixing, of creating family. And I think that's really positive.
Now, 3 minutes. Dave, would you like to wind up with a statement of some description that helps people to know how to get together with these sorts of thoughts?
Yeah. First of all, I would like to say that there are givers and takers in this world. And Gloria is a giver. I mean, she's always given, never a taker. In fact, we have to sometimes push her to receive something. So that's kind of amazing. Yeah, I think people need to start thinking beyond what they were taught in school and by their parents, because we're filled with false belief systems. And we have to get at the truth. And to get at the truth, you have to really open up your mind and not believe something just because a church tells you it's true, just because your family told you it's true. You need to, really, something isn't part of you until you've experienced it. So the way you get at the truth is you try things that you don't believe, and then they work. Like I studied out-of-body experience, and I said, this is BS, I don't believe it. And I did it, and after a month, I was doing it, going out of body, And it's like, it's real. Nobody can tell me it's not real.
Sometimes writing a book can liberate your thoughts about where you grew up. It may be you 60 years later than when you were a child.
Right. That might be. I was thinking of that as we were talking. I need to write a book. So
I think we're near the end, and thanks very much for Dave and Gloria and Danielle. And Danielle's been on WAFT as a airshifter for quite some time.
She 20 years. Started out with eclectic seizure with William Gillespie, and it just went all downhill from there. So I appreciate WAFT. I appreciate both Daves in the studio. Thank you, Dave, for engineering.
Thank you, Dave. Dave Monk, Gil Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on FM dial. And
Dave on the board. And the thumping that you hear is Ezra dashing back and forth in that four-year-old energy that he has. As always, the views expressed here are those of the speakers and nobody else. This is